are bringing Senate Finance meeting to order. Apologize for the delay. It is March 19th, 9:15. Members present is Co-Chair Kelly, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Vice Chair Fairclough. So we have just the two items before us today. The operating budget will not be taken up this morning, but that's my understanding. We're going to recess and take that up tonight. Is that correct, Senator Kelly?
That's the plan.
Okay. So today we'll just we'll finish up the discussion with Senate Bill 80. My hope and intent there is that that will be fairly quick so we can get back to House Bill 23, which was the Kinnick Arm Crossing. So if there's nothing to come before the committee right now, we would like to welcome Senator Dyson and his staff back to the table. I need a motion. We have a new CS. Is that correct? Senator Kelly, do you have that motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the Senate Finance CS for SB 80.
Okay. I'll say it again so it's on the record. I move to adopt the Senate Finance CS for SB 80.
Okay. You know, actually, I'm going to ask my staff to explain it quickly. So maybe if Christine could just grab a seat there quick. Is there any objections? Yeah, let's just accept it, unless there's any objections to the CS. Okay. There's no objections, so we'll have the CS before us. Christine, could you please put yourself on the record and explain the changes?
For the record, my name is Christine Marisigan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer and the Senate Finance Committee. The CS before you, version H, deals with Section 2, which, as you heard in committee testimony yesterday, that there were groups asking for exemptions, most notably Department of Corrections and Health and Social Services. If you look on your new version H on page 2, between lines 2 through 10, the exemption there about controlled substances specifically says that the physician has to have an established physician-patient relationship, which is the gold standard for providing care, and when appropriate, licensed healthcare provider is present with the patient. This would cover nurses. The only other change in this bill was that we have the language that the emphasis is on resident physicians, so the physician must be licensed and practicing in the state, and the follow-up care needs to be available for the patient. And those are the changes in the CS, sir. There's also now a zero fiscal note, which we have received. I don't anticipate that any of these changes in the CS will change that.
Okay, very good. We like zero fiscal notes. Senator Olson, does this address some of the concerns that was brought up yesterday?
It certainly does, Mr. Chairman, and the other physicians that I've spoken to throughout the state are much more comfortable with this committee substitute, and applaud the sponsor for working with my staff to make sure that at least the issues from a rural physician standpoint have been addressed. And so with that, I thank you for this ability.
Great. Thank you, Senator Olson. It wasn't me. It was Christine that did all the work, but thank you for the credit. Mm-hmm. Senator Fairclough.
I just wanted to confirm nurse practitioner then also.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, yes, that would be correct.
Great. Thanks a lot. Okay, Christine, let's bring the sponsor back and his staff, see what they think of the change. Senator Dyson, you've heard the CS. Oh, looks like we're going to have breakfast tomorrow.
Hospital Association.
Okay. Yeah. Make note of that. That was Karen. Okay. Senator Dyson, you heard the changes to the CS comments?
Only we too really appreciate the work of Christina, and whatever it is you think of her, it isn't high enough.
Very good. Thank you.
And indeed, we've tried to answer everyone's objections, and for Senator Olson, we understand that the AMA is now not only not objecting, but we may see a letter of endorsement from them. And I do believe that with the passage of this, the tribal health centers that treat non-Native people will be able to be reimbursed for that. Everybody appreciates the fact that they've served everyone that walks in the door, but being able to be reimbursed will be helpful.
Okay, very good. Any additional questions, thoughts, comments? Let's see, there's a zero fiscal note, then we might as well move all our head here. Senator Kelly, you got a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move CS for SB 80 out of, I move CS for SB 80 titled Out of State Physician Licenses Version H from the Senate Finance Committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, is there any objections? Seeing here none, thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Dyson.
Here.
Chuck?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, let's take brief eddies. We're back, sent to the Senate Finance. We're going to continue our discussion on House Bill 23, which is the Kinnickarn Bridge. Yesterday, we heard from the sponsor, and then we heard from my staff explaining the changes to the CS. We just kind of got started briefly, high level, on the financing aspects of it. So I'd like to get in a little more detail on the financing, and I think I... in simple terms, mentioned there's basically three parts: the TIFID bonds, the revenue bonds, and then the federal revenue receipts, road receipts. So we need to go into more detail on all three of those sections. So we invited Devin Mitchell, who is our debt bond expert, and Devin, welcome to Senate Finance. The floor is yours, sir.
Thanks. For the record, my name is Devin Mitchell. I'm the debt manager in the Department of Revenue. The CS that you see before you was an acknowledgement of some of the concern about the public-private partnership structure and the indeterminate amount of obligation that the state would be taking on within that structure, and trying to quantify and limit the state's exposure. From my office's perspective, more specifically, there was concern about using the state's debt capacity and credit for an availability support structure, an availability payment support structure, where we wouldn't receive the true benefit of that credit support. You were talking about minimally investment grade ratings rather than high AA credit ratings, which is the level that you get when you talk about a subject to appropriation, something lesser than our AAA full faith and credit GO pledge. The bill that's before you, as was pointed out by the chair, has three basic components of financing within it. The first is the federal highway funds that would be required to be appropriated to the project. The second would be the TIFIA loan that would fund about a third, and the third component would be revenue bonds of the state of Alaska, which would be supported by a subject to appropriation commitment and a moral obligation commitment of the state, as well as a subordinate claim on toll revenues. So how the transaction would work, or what's envisioned, is that the TIFIA portion, the federal government is willing to take risk on tolls if the state provides funding for the project out of its own resources. And so by providing federal highway receipts that are available to us, as well as borrowing money that we back with the state's credit rating, we can simply pledge the toll receipts on the TIFIA to the TIFIA loan, rather than having the TIFIA loan backstopped by the state of Alaska, which was the prior setting. So there's approximately $300 million worth of bonds, and the exact numbers will depend on the final cash flows. You had in your packet some information that was handed out yesterday, and maybe it would be helpful just to pull the sheet out that describes the general cost of the project. And so you have an estimated project cost needed, $894 million in the sheet. Remaining authority available for construction is $18,932,000. The budget proposal for FY15 is $55 million. Additional federal aid needed is $226 million and change. And if you look below, you can see that there's an expectation of that $226 million being funded over a five-year period at approximately $45 million a year. State-issued bonds, $251,495,000, which does not include the cost of issuance or a reserve fund that would be required for those bonds, and that would push that issuance up into the $280 million category. The bill before you currently provides an upper limit of $300 million. These bonds would be secured by, as I stated earlier, a pledge, a subject to appropriation commitment of the state to pay debt service out of general fund receipts, as well as a moral obligation reserve structure and a subordinated lien on toll revenues. The expectation is there won't be toll revenues available to pay this portion, this obligation, for some period of time, 7 to 12 years, it depends. That is something that we didn't want to focus on, as the commitment of the state is to pay whether there's toll revenues or not. And so the committee needs to recognize this is an obligation that you will be considering each and every year until it's paid off. The expectation is that the debt service on that will be approximately $20 to $25 million, based on size of the final obligation as well as interest rates at that time. TIFIA loan is projected at $341.3 million in the sheet. The TIFIA loan, the state will not be backstopping in this structure. Those will be secured solely by projected toll revenues of the bridge. And so that's one of the big benefits of this shift in structure, is that we no longer have to secure that. And the money that we're going to be borrowing, we're going to be borrowing at high AA levels, and so at the lowest possible cost. And then there's some projections of interest earnings on the construction fund that total out to $894.4 million for the project. I don't know if you want more detail on some aspect of the plan, or wanted to walk through any of the details of the bill specifically, or just want to have questions of the committee at this point.
Yeah. Devin, why don't we just take questions at this point in time. Senator Dunleavy, if I could just ask one quickie. I'm not familiar with the TIFIA loans. How difficult are those to obtain? And what's the difference between them and the revenue bonds? Because it sounds like they're both backed by the tolls that we hope to collect.
Through the chair. The state of Alaska doesn't have any TIFIA loans at this point. The TIFIA program is a federal program designed to help develop infrastructure in the United States, and there's a finite amount of funds available in the programs administered by the Federal Highway Administration. The Kubota staff has supplied a letter of interest to the TIFIA program several times in the past. The Federal Highway folks have to actually invite you to apply. And so your program, your project has to be to a point where the federal folks see it as being more shovel ready, or it has all the components in place to move forward. The TIFIA program is willing to, it has certain advantages from a structural perspective that you wouldn't be able to get in the open capital markets. It takes a very long view. It's able, you can put them in the back of your amortization. You have a very low interest rate below what you would most likely be able to get in the capital markets. And they're willing to forego interest expense in the short term. It is, in a sense, similar to a revenue bond because they will be getting a commitment of the toll receipts of the bridge on a senior lien basis, meaning that they have, after operations and maintenance are paid, the right to receive all revenue until their debt service, their loan repayment is met for that particular year. The revenue bonds that the state would be issuing would be secured by a lesser pledge of the toll receipts, and so you wouldn't have any money flowing to pay those revenue bonds unless operation and maintenance was met, the TIFIA loan was, payments were met, and there were excess revenues. If you want, I think if you want additional detail on the TIFIA program, that there are others that could speak more succinctly on its details, since I have no direct experience with the program.
Okay. No, I think that takes care of it. It basically, if the tolls don't cover it, then we'd have to cover GF, is what you're saying.
Through the chair, only on the state's revenue bonds, not on the TIFIA bonds.
Okay.
The TIFIA bonds, if the revenues are deficient, TIFIA doesn't get repaid until the revenues are sufficient. So the repayment would be essentially deferred until such time as toll revenues were sufficient to pay.
Okay, gotcha.
So there would be risk being taken by TIFIA.
By the federal government? Is
exactly.
That, okay. Very good. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, to the chair. So this, when it comes to the tolls, is it structured that the state would get first dib on the tolls to pay for our obligation, and then what's left over goes to TIFIA, or is TIFIA getting first dibs on the tolls?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the TIFIA program would have a first lien on tolls. They would have first dibs. The state would take a subordinated lien position on tolls, and we would have a second right to those revenues. In a normal scenario, that on its own would not be financeable, and that's why there's a requirement that there be a commitment of the state to backstop the revenue bonds that the state would issue.
So the full faith and credit of the state would have to end up backing the state-issued bonds, where with the federal TIFIA, the tolls pay for it, great. If they don't, the Fed's on the hook, but if the tolls aren't paying for the TIFIA bond, then the tolls would not necessarily pay for the state bonds. It's an assumption.
Through the chair, that's correct. On the first part, it wouldn't be a full faith and credit pledge of the state. It would be a lesser pledge, what's called a subject to appropriation pledge or a moral obligation pledge, which are similar to other obligations that have come before this body, most recently the residential housing facility that's located at the Alaska Native Medical Center that the state's funding through a vehicle called a Certificate of Participation, which is a subject to appropriation commitment of the state. And we expect that to receive AA+, AA1 type ratings. There's a choice each year of the legislature to appropriate or not for that obligation. There are negative ramifications. If you don't, you get downgraded. And you lose the use of the facility in that particular instance. In this instance, there would be negative ramifications as well through if there were a failure to appropriate. So it is a high-level commitment of the state to pay the revenue bonds of the state, up to $300 million that's authorized by the bill, but not on the TIFIA. The TIFIA is there won't need to be hand-wringing if there are at this table, if there are insufficient tolls to pay the TIFIA loan.
Through the chair. So in the end, and this is a different approach than last year, in the end, what is the absolute maximum exposure of the state in worst-case scenario?
Through the chair. The bill authorizes $300 million in revenue bonds. So it'd be once the debt is sold, you can't just take it off the table. It's typically sold with a 10-year call, and so you would have, in a worst-case scenario, you would have the $300 million in principal that would have to be repaid, plus interest on that money over up to a 20-year expected issuance life. So you could wind up with $450 million in total exposure of the state.
One last question.
Go ahead.
Through the chair. Are you much more comfortable with this approach than the approach that was brought forward last year?
Through the chair, definitely. If you compare the costs of that $450 million to a private activity bond that was contemplated previously to be issued by a consortium, that the state would have that same subject to appropriation commitment or moral obligation commitment to pay at Baa1 or triple B, even not even Baa1 type ratings. The benefit, we were taking the same risk, but for a lot more money. And so in this case, we've reduced our potential exposure by hundreds of millions of dollars on that financing. In that construct, we also were backstopping the TIFIA loan. We've eliminated that exposure in this construct. And we were also backstopping an equity investment by the consortium, which we've also eliminated, that equity rate of return for the consortium. So all that combined is a significant benefit to the state from just a financial perspective. There can be other considerations as far as, oh, could the project be managed more effectively potentially by a private consortium versus what's being contemplated at this point. That aside, just pulling out the financing, we're saving hundreds of millions, if not close to or over $1 billion.
So just one last one.
Go ahead, Senator.
So $450 million is the top exposure for the state under this plan. It would be $300 million plus the 20 years, the interest if we had to pay it all back with no revenue, no tolls. Our exposure is $450 million tops.
Through the chair, that's correct.
So it would cost the state, theoretically speaking, $450 million for a bridge from the state's obligations, maximum.
Through the chair, once the project is funded and underway, that's correct.
On that point, Mr.
Chairman. Go ahead,
Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
And I see that in Section 3 and in AS 3715 2.30, which says that the revenue bonds may not exceed $300 million. Then I go to the second page, which I referred to yesterday. If that's the case, then that's a total liability. Then we should exclude any approval of additional appropriations by the legislature, if you are correct.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. So are you referring to on the
last
second page?
Bond reserve funds. Why do we have that additional language in the third funding funds with consists of appropriations approved by the legislature?
If I understand the question correctly, there are two different sections of statute that are included in the work draft. And so if you're referring in one section to the Kinnick-Arm Bridge and Toll Authority's statutes and in another section to 3715 creates its own authority. It's contemplated that the authority to issue revenue bonds by Kubota would no longer be exercised because there's not a need for Kubota to borrow any money. And so I guess maybe I'm not understanding your question.
My question is, why do we have to have the language appropriations approved by the legislature in this legislation as it's outlined in the bond reserve fund?
Through the chair, that's what formulates the basis of the state's commitment and allows these obligations to be marketable.
And that is limited to the 300 plus the interest?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. And Devin, you mentioned that the TIFIA bonds isn't really your area of expertise. Who would we talk to about that? Is that DOT?
DOT, or I think, I don't know, Jeff Stark was here yesterday. He's had a lot of discussions. I saw somebody from Federal Highways here yesterday. I don't know if they're here today.
Oh, well, okay, I see some people back there. All right, great. Yeah, I guess my question there.
That was not Senator Dunleavy, by the way. Gotcha, buddy.
Yeah, it just seems to me that since the federal government's taken a risk on these TIFIA bonds, that they're not going to issue them unless they feel like it's a pretty good project. Is that safe to say?
Through the chair, that's correct. I think the state's going to have its obligation on the table. And that's what they were looking for in the last structure as well. That's why the TIFIA application, as I understand it, they haven't been invited to apply because the state's skin wasn't in the game. Where by authorizing this revenue structure, as has been pointed out, their state's got an obligation. And that allows TIFIA to move forward. And we expect that we would be able to be invited to apply.
Okay, excellent. Senator Fairclough, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of them. First, you, Devin, you might not be the right person to ask this, but you talk typically about selling bonds in a 10-year increment. Is that correct? Because there's a lost opportunity in there for interest and the cost of that borrowing capacity, and we've got another bill coming out of the Senate Finance Committee that's trying to address that. So can you talk to me about that?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough. When I mentioned 10 years, that's simply the date at which the bonds can be paid off. So typically when tax-exempt municipal bonds are issued, they have a 10-year call provision. So for the first 10 years, you're locked in. So the investors know they're going to have that deal for 10 years. But more typically, bonds are priced along the yield curve, so you'll have a maturity in each one of the years that goes by between now and final maturity. So you take advantage of an increasing yield curve by paying off a bond that matures, as we just sold some GO debt last week that priced at an interest rate of 0.01, so 10 basis points for a year. And then if you go 25 years down the yield curve, maybe you're at a 3.5. So we take advantage of that, and if there are opportunities to adjust that, we consider those.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, this committee has been increasingly focused on debt and what debt means as far as our borrowing ability, the interest rate that we can receive at the market. And so what I'm wondering on this project, or what I'd like to see, is a cash flow scenario, because what I don't want to do is go out and borrow $300 million and have it sit in our bank and we're paying interest on it, because we're a net loss there, even though we're recouping money because we're drawing interest, which you point out, interest earnings on construction bond fund of $1 million. It would be nice to see what the correlating interest cost is to the state of Alaska for even borrowing that money. So what I'm saying is, if we're going to proceed, then I'd like to see the runs on when the cash is needed so that we're not borrowing too far out. And I understand incremental financing and incremental going to the market for the bonds. I just want to make sure that we're taking that into account and not trying to float $300 million on the market and then wind up paying interest for money that's just sitting in our bank and we're net losing on that proposition.
Through the chair, sorry, I misunderstood your question, and that's a very valid point, that that we wouldn't want to borrow long, and we've had that experience at the state level where we've borrowed long, and then we're forced to invest short because we have to have the ability to spend that money in the near term, and then the projects aren't ready, and so we sit there paying, even if it's only 3.5%, and reinvesting it 30 basis points, or, you know, so we will obviously work to avoid that and are happy to work on providing you a cash flow.
Great. Senator Furcock, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize to the committee. I wasn't here yesterday to hear the rollout on the bill. I was prepping for the floor session yesterday. Is there a piece in the CS that says that we will not issue any bonds until the TIFIA portion has been approved?
Through the chair, that's a fundamental requirement of the project moving forward, that you really need to have all the components in place. So before we're going to borrow $300 million, you need to have, and before TIFIA is going to lend us $300-plus million, we're going to need to have all of the components in place.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Then lastly, Mr. Chairman, the only thing else in the spreadsheet that is what if is additional federal aid needed of $226 million. And so you're probably not the right person to ask, but I see that as the risk that still stays out there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Any additional questions for our debt manager? Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Bishop, you're on the list, then I'll go to Senator Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, Devin, you said earlier our debt service would be $20 to $25 million a year on the $300 million. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, and I apologize. I left a little early too. Just one quick question: has DOT, and I don't know if they presented yesterday.
No.
After I left,
they're next.
They're due. I'll wait. I'll hold my question for them. Thanks.
Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, I guess, is similar to Senator Fairclough's. Is on our target for our bonding capacity at 8%. We have the one bill that we dealt with here yesterday. We have Susitna, and then we have this one. I wonder if you can give us later a sheet showing where we would be if we had indebted the state on all three of those projects. And the other question, I think, is in Section 3, which discusses the requirements of the State Bond Committee to evaluate whether the toll revenues are adequate to make the principal payments on the interest in the bonds. And I'm wondering if that is, the reason for that is that considered an off-ramp for the state of Alaska? I don't think you can answer that, but I think the sponsor may be able to answer that better. But, if the evaluation isn't adequate to pay off those bonds, is that an off ramp for the state?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, the provisions in Title 19 are related to the authorization for Kubota to issue bonds. So there was that checkoff for revenue bonds that Kubota might consider issuing. There is, since the State Bond Committee is the issuer of the $300 million, there's no such, and there really isn't an expectation in the short term that the tolls will be sufficient to pay the debt service. That checkoff does not exist for the $300 million.
Anything else, Senator Hoffman?
No.
Okay.
Thanks.
Senator Olson, do you have a question?
Actually, I thought Senator Dunleavy had a question before. I was just going to.
Yep. Okay. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. Cost overruns. Who would be responsible for cost overruns under the plan?
I think that DOT could answer that better than I could.
Thank you.
Okay. And DOT is next on the list, by the way. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, thanks for coming out this morning. Certainly, you are one of the people that has some credibility because you're at arm's length from this whole process, because your job is not necessarily dependent on whether this project goes forward or not, as opposed to people that are almost in the realm of having a conflict of interest. But as I look at this issue with related to public policy, and you are probably in the best position to go and answer that, because public policy is what we as politically elected officials are dealing with, something like this, where you have a project that is there, the numbers are in question, as was pointed out by the legislative audit that was put last year, and I understand that, you know, the PPA has been done away and they've come up with a new proposal. But as you look into the future from your standpoint, and you see the production of oil that we've been talking about for the last however many years going down, obviously the revenues are going down, that means that the savings are going to be going down. Our bond rating, would you agree, is also going to be going down, because once we start going to the financial institutions for more money, they're going to say, hey, where's all your money, state of Alaska? Where's all your indebtedness? You got another bonded indebtedness that you're going on here. Or maybe I'm missing the whole issue. Maybe you have a better, you have a more objective, since obviously finances is what your expertise is, and I'm assuming that's what your degree is in college. Mine was in chemistry, and so you have a better, more objective way to allay the fears of those people like myself that see another white elephant in the offing. So am I correct in my thinking, or where am I off in my thinking?
Through the chair, I think what this plan does is, and perhaps it addresses your concerns, is that it defines the commitment of the state in a much more concise fashion, that we know that we're going to pay maybe $450 million for this project in the future in debt service. And from a policy perspective, that's somebody else's job to figure out whether or not this is where you want to spend $450 million. That's your jobs. I know that the folks in my office support it.
I clear up my question. When I see the downslope of oil production, I see the downslope of our savings, as we on the Finance Committee are well aware of here. Is it true that the bond rating is also going to be going down from a AAA? We can't go any higher than that, obviously. So, I mean, is that true or not?
Through the chair, that will be the challenge. Certainly.
So it is true. I do have another question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
You talked about $20 or $25 million being the debt service on the $300 million that we are going to be bonding for. Is that per year?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I didn't hear your question.
Okay. We have a bond we're going out for somewhere around $300 million.
Mm-hmm.
You made the comment that it's going to cost between $20 to $25 million. Is that per year or is that total?
Through the chair, that would be per year.
So if it goes out 10 years, like you said, it's going to be 7 to 12 years before we can pay it back, we're going to be paying that every year?
Through the chair, you'd be paying it every year for 20 or 25 years.
So indeed, there's going to be a far larger amount than the $300 million that we put out there in the initial bond package that was sold.
Through the chair, up to I would estimate right now up to $450 million.
I have no further questions of him, Mr. I guess my only comment is, as we look at the insolvency of the state and those issues that are in front of us, like I said, those kind of numbers certainly catch my attention, Mr. Chairman.
Well, yeah, no, you bring up some good points there, Olson, and that's the balance that we have to make as a Finance Committee. You know, we have school debt at 70-30 that's out there. You got a pipeline that we're going to be heavily in debt on. We got a $250 million power plant that we got to borrow on or pull out of savings. And we have to balance schools, pipelines, power plants with bridges.
Or down a dam, all the other stuff.
And dams with bridges. And they're all, important aspects of government. And so we'll just have to work our way through that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to throw out comments on the bond rating and that being attached to the decline of oil. It really is how the state of Alaska chooses to respond to that decline and what we've done to meet our obligation. So I believe, and I think we heard from the Commissioner of Revenue, that if we're making our payments and if we look at a five-year revenue picture and we're meeting those obligations inside of that window of 5 years, they certainly look longer than that too, but inside that five-year window, that we will maintain our rating. But they are watching when it comes to the pension obligation. We owe $12 billion, at least that's the projected number, to retirees, and depending on what we put in that fund towards that obligation, they'll be watching to see how that affects our operating budget and how that ratio of debt works in there. But Alaska has a wonderful opportunity that revenue continues to benefit us on, as well as our own permanent fund board. We have $50 billion in the bank, unlike any other state in America, that helps our credit rating be what it is today. And when we talk about school debt, I think that is certainly something that we need to consider. But personally, if you know that you're unemployed or that you don't have money, sometimes the best thing to do is to pay off some of those debts and pay down your future obligations so that you're positioned well to ride until you've got the new job, till more oil comes online. And so the last thing, Mr. Chairman, you talked about was the pipeline. And I just want to say that we have positioned, at least out of the Senate, to make sure that Alaska can carry that debt, that it's not huge until we actually have contracts signed with a buyer. Our debt will not be huge on that, and that we will not be borrowing money that we can't afford to pay back. So just wanted to make sure that was on the record, that this committee has been looking very seriously at debt, and Senator Olson raises concerns that we all have about how we're managing those things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just one more time, too. So $450 million is, from your perspective, the maximum exposure of the state. But if the tolls do pay the TIFIA, and there are tolls, the tolls will also pay for this as well, correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
So once again, $450 is maximum worst-case exposure from your perspective.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, additional questions? Senator Olson?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, as Senator Dunleavy brought out, you got almost $500 million there that we are maximally exposed to, is what you're saying. But let's say that the tolls do not take that, and there are cost overruns to the project. Where does that money come from? And part of the reason I bring this up is because as we look at TIFIA, obviously those funds may come, but if you look at least the expressed success of TIFIA applications in the past, it has not been, I would be somewhat pessimistic as to its ability to go ahead and be able to get one of those there. So my question has to do, if you've got almost $500 million in debt service, what are the backup plans if we start running out of money, when we start looking at some things that are more near and dear to our heart that benefit all of the state of Alaska with the Senate Bill 138, which is the LNG project? What are the backup plans?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the bonds wouldn't be issued unless the total anticipated funding need of the project was in hand. So your first concern might be addressed by that. As far as cost overruns, I think DOT could answer that question. There are going to be the same options available to fund cost overruns, whether it's federal highway receipts, additional state leveraging, or additional TIFIA borrowing.
My last comment, Mr. Chairman, and since you're here from the Department of Revenue, as we look at some of the, and you're dealing, and I look to you for public policy questions that I have out there, because we are the ones that make the ultimate decision. As you look at some of the big projects that have gone over budget, you know, a good example is one right there in that heart of where it's going to, Goose Bay Prison. That project went millions and millions of dollars over cost. And so because of that, I guess I'm hesitant to go ahead and do another project that has questionable numbers to start off with. Questionable in the point of the total amount that's going to revenues that are going to be generated, the amount it's going to cost to go ahead and do phase one and phase two of that project, and the whole setup there causes questions in the way they've conducted themselves over the last 6 months with the people over there on Government Hill. And with that, I thank you for coming out this morning.
All right, Devin. Sometimes being the first one is the toughest, but you know you have a tough job. You've done an excellent job of keeping the state's credit rating at the highest it can possibly be, and we're putting a lot of demands on you through as we talked about the schools, potentially the pipeline, and we need a power plant at UAF, and the pension obligation is getting out of control, and we're trying to deal with that, and then of course just the road bonds that we sent the teams. We tend to pass every couple of years. So excellent job. Thank you for the presentation. And we'll let you off the hot seat for now and ask DOT to join us. We have Jeff Otteson and I believe Judy. Are you coming up together or separate? Or?
I think together.
Well, there's safety in numbers. So welcome to Senate Finance. If you could, please put your name on the record and proceed.
I'm Judy Doherty. I'm the Acting Executive Director for Kanikon Bridge and Toll Authority.
And I'm Jeff Otteson, the Director of Program Development within the Department of Transportation.
Okay, just so the committee knows, Jeff, you would answer the part about the federal receipts, highway federal receipts portion that's being used to fund this.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And Judy, you'd be able to deal with questions dealing with the TIFIA bonds?
That's correct.
Okay, excellent. All right, then... go ahead and proceed with your
well, I'll start if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just refer you back to this one-page sheet with the orange bars. And there's a column that's labeled Federal Formula Funds. That is the amount of funds that is needed in this approximately one-third, one-third, one-third financing arrangement for the project. The total is $295 million in federal receipts, not including match funds. And that first number at the top of the column, $18.9 million, is remaining earmarked funds available to the project. So that is essentially money that's already in the bank available for the project. It will not be subtractive of other projects across the state. So we're really talking about something closer to $276 million of federal receipts going forward between now and the year 2020. So at this point, I want to give you some idea, because I know there's been a lot of questions. We've heard it from many sources about what is the impact of the Kubota financing plan on other projects around the state. Let me make one point right at the start. The financing scheme is based upon National Highway System funding, actually called today National Highway Performance Program, NHPP funding. These are dollars we receive from the Federal Highway Administration for our national highway system. Dollars that come from the Surface Transportation Program and other smaller categories of federal funds are not at issue. So the projects that rely upon STP funding, which is essentially everything that is not on the national highway system, community roads, other state highways that are not part of the national highway system, are not impacted at all by this financing scheme. It's only the projects on the basically the big roads of the state. The project in 2015 is in the budget for $50 million in federal funding, and this is about 10.3% of our overall funding that we get per year, or about 17% of our national highway funding we get percent. So that just gives you a sense of scale. After 2015, the amount of funding would drop back to about $45 million per year in 2016 through 2020. And this would drop the percentage, total percentage, to 9.3%, and out of the national highway system to about 15%. When I look at the current portfolio of national highway system projects that are in the design pipeline, that are being progressed through all the necessary steps to make them eligible for construction dollars, we have about a 12-year list of projects that are actively being worked on. If you add the Kinnick Arm project to that list, it becomes a 13-year list. So it's a relatively small add to the total amount of projects that are already underway. And what that really means, if you just think about it in a simple mathematical sense, the average project that's currently being worked on would expect to go somewhere between the sixth or seventh year, about midway through the 12-year period. And we've essentially added about a half a year to that average wait to funding, which now goes up to about 6.5 years. But of course, not all projects are created equally, and not all projects would have to wait. Some will be progressed as rapidly with the project as without, and others would have to wait. So the question is then, what type of projects would we give the high priority and not slow down? And also, what are the projects that would be waiting a longer period of time to make room for the Kibata project? Well, I can give you one example. We would be looking at factors of safety, traffic volume, project readiness, how close it is to being ready, and other factors that are basically important to those projects. The type of projects that we'd be looking at would be the widening of the Parks Highway through Wasilla, where we have a highway safety corridor and we have a very bad congestion problem. We're also widening the Seward Highway near Midtown and Anchorage. Likewise, it's a project we would not slow down to progress the Kibata project. The some other examples would be the safety corridor near Girdwood, and a little further south on the Seward Highway, we have a section of the Seward Highway that has 8 deficient bridges. They were all built right after 1964. They're all structurally deficient, and you have to continue that project to make sure the network has continuity. You don't end up with a broken network that has a bridge that can't be crossed. So that makes it pretty easy to define the really important projects. So what are the projects we would be looking at to slow down? Well, there's a series of projects in the NHS program that were started when we all thought the big pipeline was going through Canada. So the logistics routes to bring that pipe into the state, as well as the roads and bridges along that pipeline route down the Richardson Highway to Delta and further east on the Alaska Highway to the border, those projects right now are not as high priority as they were when we thought the pipeline was going to be being constructed and using those routes. We also have some work on the Haines Highway, which at that time was going to be the largest logistics haul of the entire pipeline project. So we have that project in our portfolio. We can slow that down a year or two. We won't be canceling these projects. We'll simply be moving them out in time somewhat. So as you can see, it really is a rather small impact overall on the program. We'll be progressing important projects at the same schedule we already would be. We will be delaying some projects typically by a matter of 1 or 2 years. In reality, I think there's a way to explain why this impact will be even less than I just suggested. Every year, a certain number of our projects don't make the finish line. We expect them to make the finish line. We put them in the program called the STIP for a given year, and something happens. Our success rate is about 70%, meaning that 30% of our projects don't make the finish line, and they have to be delayed a year. The causes are usually the same list of suspects. We don't get a permit. We don't get a right-of-way parcel in time. We had some problem with the workload being too high and that project being set back just for lack of staff or consultant time. Any number of things happen. I said our success rate is 70% nationally. The other states, about 60%. So this is not an abnormal event. This happens in all states. It's really part of the complexity of the federal process that we pursue projects under. So what happens to those dollars that were destined to those projects that were scheduled for a given year? Quite frankly, they have to be used somewhere else, or they leave the state. It's use or lose funding. So if we aren't good managers of the program and pursuing a list of projects larger in number and larger in dollar value than the actual dollars we expect to have and have projects ready to go as substitutes, we will lose those dollars. We don't lose dollars in the state of Alaska. It's really one of our built-in, it's in our DNA at DOT. We simply don't want federal dollars to leave the state. So the Kibata project then becomes a natural place to send those dollars that got delayed by the natural slippage of other projects. Thereby, you have the possibility of funding this project with very little impact on ongoing work that's active. So that if a project is delayed for a natural reason, Kibata didn't cause that problem, but Kibata benefits and the state benefits by having a place to send those dollars to. I would finish that thought by saying, in addition to projects being delayed typically, and it happens every year, we in the last few years have seen an awful lot of extra funding coming to the state. I spoke before this committee about 3 weeks ago about this. We had over $100 million become available in the last quarter of the year due to project closeouts and a mandate that we got from our federal partners that we had to close out projects and we had to close them out pronto and not wait till the next fiscal year. Over $100 million suddenly became available. Again, these kinds of events make Kibata a natural recipient as a place to spend dollars without impacting the rest of the state. So with that, I would take questions.
Senator Bishop.
It's more of a comment, Jeff, is, and you touched on it briefly, you know, the other pipeline and the other routes that you talked about. Now we've got another pipeline that we passed out yesterday, and I would just like, and I'm sure you're all over this, but just for my benefit, that you guys are coordinating with the alignment of the new producers, because they've got a route to Willow, but they don't have a route across, and I just would not like, I'd hate to see the pipe and the bridge, you know what I mean, add cost to one project or the other. So I'd like to see some good coordination between the two entities.
Not a question, but I can certainly respond.
Okay,
through the chair, Senator Bishop. We have a full-time staffer working right now on pipeline issues, the multiple pipeline issues, and I'm sure he's coordinating. I haven't spoken to him recently, but I do know that, you know, we just last summer had a bridge become structurally deficient on the Dalton Highway, and within less than a month, we had funding assigned to that project to start redesign for reconstruction. So, you know, we're paying attention to that route. We know how important it is. And the good news is the Commerce Corridor of the Parks Highway and the Dalton Highway has long had our attention, long before the pipeline proposals. So the bridges and segments of that route are getting better. I can say last summer alone, we funded 13 pairs of passing lanes on the Parks Highway. So it's a lot of attention is being paid on what essentially will be not only the construction route, but the logistics route.
Okay, Senator Faircliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Otteson, will DOT then be managing the project?
Through the chair, Senator Faircliff. No, this is a Kibata-led project. The underlying statute that established Kibata really puts them in charge. We do have a responsibility. The way the Federal Highway Administration views the project is Alaska DOT is the recipient of the federal dollars that go into the project, both past and future. And we have an obligation to ensure that the federal rules are being followed. Kibata is a sub-recipient under that construct. So we have a role to play, but they're the day-to-day managers of the project.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then can I assume that DOT is taking a 12% cut on those dollars or some number, and then Kibata uses another 12% of those dollars for administration or a much lower number?
Through the chair, Senator Faircliff, our current administrative overhead number is about 5%, and I think we've negotiated actually a lower percentage because this project is so large.
Thank
but that's what's paying for an awful lot of the backroom activities, you know, the accounting system and the people that work in it and those kinds of steps.
Go ahead.
Mr. Otteson, so as proposed today, approximately 33% of this bridge would be paid by users through the collection of tolls over a period of time. Is that I see Ms. Doherty standing up. So in 33%, the state in general numbers, a third is paying, and then we're using a third of our federal money as it comes in over time for the project. Is that how the construct is?
You go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry. I okay. Wasn't following the question.
I'm sorry. I did. So through the chair, Senator Faircliff. Yeah, the approximate percentages. It's a little higher for TIFIA, about $351 million. And I think the state share is $300 million, and the federal share, if you include the money that's already on the shelf in the form of earmark funds, it's just under $300 million.
Go ahead, Senator Faircliff.
Mr. Chairman, I was trying to alleviate my concern that on the spreadsheet that we received dated March 1st, 2014, it says additional federal aid needed of $226 million. And so I was trying to get my head around the comment that was said that this represents about a third. And so when I look at TIFIA financing from the federal government, a third, really we expect revenue, toll revenue, to pay that portion of that third back. At least that's our hope. And then the state is proposing to borrow up to $300 million, which will make incremental payments over time, depending on how much we need to borrow at a particular time. And so we've heard in this committee that that number is between 20 and 25 million, but that is if we borrowed all 300 million on day one. So that number would ramp up over time as those obligations ramped up. And then what I heard is that as the federal government continues to support the national highway system, that we'll have a portion of our highway system dollars that is not proposed, at least as we look at it today, to displace other projects, that we would try to be picking up anything that's left on the table, as well as prioritizing projects in out years that might be pushed off for a year, but not displacing projects that are in the queue. So in large numbers, a third of the public payment, a third from the federal government, and a third from the state. Do I have it right?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. If I can follow up on that. So and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but approximately a third of the funding would come from federal road receipts. Now, does that include the additional roads in the city of Anchorage that will have to be done in Government Hill or the roads that we'll have to build on the other side in Point McKenzie?
If I might answer.
Sure. If you could, put your name on the record, though, for us.
This is Judy Doherty with Kubota. The project limits extend from Government Hill area out to Port McKenzie. And the project that's being proposed here for funding is within those limits. This funding does not include roadway projects outside those limits.
Okay. I think that's something we will want to address as we proceed here, because I know that's a concern on the Anchorage side is can the existing roads handle this additional traffic coming in from the valley?
And what's the back of the napkin estimate of those additional roads?
The estimate for roads outside the project limits?
Correct.
I don't have that information.
Thanks.
Okay. And that's something we'll want to get as we proceed here.
Right. I'd just like to add that we're confined to those project limits by the Federal Highway Administration. Those project limits have cleared NEPA, all of our permitting activities. Everything is contained within those limits. We're not able to do projects outside those limits.
And we understand that, but you're sitting next to the DOT guy who can help with those roads. So.
Yeah, if I can add, Mr. Chairman, the success of this project would be measured by the fact that it's carrying a lot of traffic, which is then causing problems as that traffic enters the existing road network in Anchorage. But at the same token, if you look at the way it works, you start generating revenue with higher traffic, and that revenue, when it's excess of the need of paying on first the TIFIA bonds and later the state bonds, there'll come a time when there's excess revenue that is available for projects. The construct of this is that these dollars must be spent on highway projects eligible under Title 23 rules, subject to appropriation of the legislature. So, this is long term. This goes well beyond the payoff of the bonds. This is in perpetuity. These dollars are available for the state.
Okay. Yeah. And my only concern is I know Mayor Sullivan will say, hey, you got all this traffic hitting my local roads, state of Alaska, help us out here. So
we've had conversations with Mayor Sullivan about the project. He's a strong supporter of the project. And one of the things that the municipality has expressed is that once traffic does start ramping up, that there be an effort to to bring forward the Ingra Gamble connection, which is part of our project, at the earliest possible date in order to help alleviate those traffic issues.
Okay. And we'll have more discussion as Senator Dunleavy comes back, because I don't know what it's like on the other side, on the valley side, so if there's roads that need to be built there. Okay, Senator, were you done, Senator Fairclough? I think I jumped on your comment. Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we go back and look at the audit report on page 19, when we were considering the last year's project, and I'm trying to reconcile, even though the funding mechanism or the funding scheme has changed, there is a drastic difference between the construction costs. On page 19, it shows the total cost of the project at $1.6 billion, and this one at $900 million. So there's a $700 million difference, and I know a lot of that is in the financing. But when you look at the first line where it talks about construction, the construction costs and the right-of-way costs were right around $1.25 billion, and this project in no way comes close to that. And then to address some of the chairman's issues, on the other side we have Port McKenzie road upgrades at $15 million, and there's a lot of other things. So Jeff, I wonder if you can try to reconcile what has changed in this project to reduce the cost so drastically.
Through the chair, Senator DeHoffman, I'd like to answer that question. The numbers that you see in the audit were taken from the TIFIA letter of interest. Under TIFIA, you're allowed to borrow based on the total project costs from the very beginning of your project pre-construction development. So all of the costs that have been expended to date, including the Commerce grant to the Matsu Borough to do work on the other side of the inlet, all those project costs from pre-construction through construction get included in the 33% participation from TIFIA. So the $1.6 billion that you're seeing there includes all of those costs, and it also includes costs that are estimated for the capacity improvements and roadway expansion within the project limits, so the Ingra Gamble connection and the widening to four lanes. So this $900 million that you're seeing, or close to $900 million, is just for phase one of the project. It's the four-lane foundation, but two-lane roadway, initial construction. And it's from, like, this point forward. It doesn't include any previously expended costs. I'd also like to point out that the actual cost estimate for the project, the construction cost estimate, is $782 million. The $894 that you see here is it's costs. It's not a cost, but it's a capacity to take care of things like overruns. I know overruns were mentioned earlier. The Federal Highway Administration requires that you do an assessment of potential risk of overruns, and that you have a financial plan that shows how that you'll take care of those costs, and that's what this represents.
Mr. Chairman, on that point?
Go ahead, Senator.
So as you look at the process of trying to get TIFIA funds that are out there, are you inferring that some of the numbers are inflated?
It's a requirement of the Federal Highway Administration to show that you have sufficient resources to take the project all the way through and to address some things that might not be known at this time.
So you do agree that they are inflated to a certain degree?
That's correct.
Try to make sure you have cost overruns taken into
That's
consideration.
Correct.
Thank
yes.
you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Excuse me.
And again, if you could put your affiliation on the record. You're with CAPATA, is that correct?
That's correct. I'm the acting executive director with CAPATA.
Okay, excellent, Judy. And then I'm going to go back here. I hope I'm not interfering with some questions committee members had. But what, in your opinion, what are the chances of getting the TIFIA loans? Because I've not heard of them before, and I don't know how easily obtained they are from the federal government.
Well, we have had a letter of interest in for a number of years, and I'm sure you've heard the criticism that we've been turned down. But I'd like to go back a little bit to what, you know, TIFIA's purpose is. The purpose of TIFIA is to provide financing for these large infrastructure projects where the traffic and toll revenue, like in a new startup project exactly like ours, isn't anticipated to be able to secure the full funding for the project. TIFIA's goal is to encourage non-federal participation in these infrastructure projects. And that's what's happening with the state bond contribution. So we feel very comfortable that we will secure these TIFIA funds. I don't think the Department of Revenue would bring forward a financing plan that included TIFIA unless there was a relative assurity that we were going to get these funds. So we feel confident that with this showing of strong support from the state that we will be successful with securing TIFIA.
Okay, excellent. Yes, go ahead, Mr.
If I may add to that, Jeff Otteson again. We're facing the end of the current federal authorization, MAP 21, which funds the federal highway program. So there are proposals now coming out of Congress and coming out of the White House for the next version of the highway authorization. In virtually all of those proposals that I've seen, they are proposing to either enlarge TIFIA or to create a new federal infrastructure bank, which would work much like TIFIA to finance projects and help jumpstart them. It seems like the idea is catching on, and the resources that will be provided for financing projects like Kibata are going to grow in virtually all these current legislative proposals.
Excellent. Senator Olson, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm not sure who wants to answer the question, but let's just go back to TIFIA. What does TIFIA stand for?
It stands for Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act.
Okay. As you look at the project's history, there's also a project called TIGER. Remind me what that stands for. If you're not, I'll tell you what it stands for. It's Traffic Investment Generation of Economic Recovery. And what we have in those two projects is the Kibata project has a number of times asked for funding from those two federal projects. Now, as you look at what the governor's public policy standpoint, he doesn't want to go ahead and put his full faith and trust in federal monies coming to Alaska to do projects. A good example is Medicare or Medicaid, expanding the Medicaid project. We are indeed doing exactly that. We're planning on having federal funding money come to the state of Alaska with the hopes that, you know, we'll be there. And I agree with the governor to a certain degree. We are getting into a financial straitjacket that's not going to allow us to go ahead and have these projects out there. But what I really want to point out is not so much what they stand for, but let's look at their history of what's going on with the TIFIA projects, the TIGER projects that are out there that have been applied for by the Kibata project. In 2010, there were 39 applications submitted. 4 were approved. As you go through the process, let's look at 2014. So far, and I realize this is early in the year, 4 applications, and actually their letter of interest, have been submitted. Nothing has been applied. So let's go back to last year, 2013. 2013 shows 34 letters of interest have been submitted, 6 have been approved. That's 17%. That means you've got less than 1 chance out of 5 that this project is going to realize any TIFIA funding that's out there. And so, as opposed to, I think your words were, I feel very comfortable that we're going to be getting this project funded. I guess I'd beg to differ. If we have less than a 1 chance getting funding out there, or where is my thinking wrong in this whole process?
Through the chair, you know, we share your frustration to some degree. When TIFIA was first getting started in the early years, there were delays in getting getting the structure in place to be able to put in a letter of interest and to apply for these funds. The TIFIA office looks to project readiness, and many of the projects who have applied don't have their NEPA NEPA document done. They don't. They aren't as mature as this project. And so I stand by feeling confident that we will secure these funds. You know, on the off chance that we don't, we still have to put together a finance plan that satisfies Federal Highway Administration. Nothing will be obligated until we have that financial plan that the feds approve. There will be no contract signed. There's absolutely no risk to try and go forward and secure these TIFIA funds, which are low interest. They're very patient. You don't pay back TIFIA for up to 5 years after your project opens and you start collecting tolls. There's a recognition there on the part of TIFIA that on a startup facility like this, it's going to take some time to build up some revenue. And so it's a best value proposition for the state to try and secure these TIFIA funds. And that's what we intend to do.
If I can continue, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Go ahead, sir.
Ms. Doherty, you talked about the municipality of Anchorage being, or I guess Mayor Sullivan, who's obviously running for higher office, is in favor of this strong support. If he's such in favor, why is the municipality of Anchorage putting up bonds to try and help further this project?
Through the chair, I can't speak for the municipality. I can't answer that question.
It appears that there's a lack of confidence that this project is indeed going to operate in the black. And that's where I'm drawing away from this. But if I can go on to the next question, Mr.
Yeah, let me just correct one thing, Senator Olson. Is Senator Fairclough and I both were on the Anchorage Assembly, and you wouldn't expect the city of Anchorage to put these roads on a road bond yet until they're assured that they have the necessary bonding in place and make sure the project's going to go forward. Senator Fairclough, did you want to add?
Well, I just wanted to add that there are major state highway corridors that run through Anchorage that the municipality is not responsible for. So I'm not sure on Ingra Gamble whether that's a state right-of-way or not. Maybe Mr. Otteson could answer that. And there are other large highways that actually run through Anchorage.
Did you want to comment on that, Mr. Otteson?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, yes, Ingra Gamble are both state highways. It's been, as someone who has worked with communities in nominating projects, the number of communities who have been willing to put in their own financing in projects has been a relatively rare event. Matt Sue is probably the most excellent example of being, they've actually passed a bond issue for jointly funding certain projects with their bonds and state highway funding brought from the Federal Highway Administration. I'd like to just give you a sense of the difference between the old financial scheme and the one today before you. The old one was relying essentially on 100% of the payback of bonds coming from traffic. And that's why it looked somewhat suspect, because traffic has to start and build. As more things get built on the far side of the bridge, you start generating more traffic. This scheme is focusing on just the TIFIA funds, relying upon on the traffic, a little more than a third of the funding. So you've already cut your expectation of revenue from traffic by two-thirds compared to the previous proposal. But what does that mean in terms of cars per day? The General Douglas Bridge is about 9,500 cars per day going across that bridge. And to pay back the TIFIA bond funds takes about 10,000 cars. So contrast Douglas population and Juneau's population with Anchorage and Matsu, I think you can see it's not unreasonable to assume that we'll achieve traffic volumes rather quickly that equal the Juneau Douglas Bridge, because the two population centers on either side of the bridge at Kibata are just much, much larger.
Yeah, and Jeff, the other thing you have to weigh too is if the bridge isn't built, then you have to do something with the Glen Highway, either add another lane or...
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
And obviously,
we have to build capacity one way or another. And that's another point about this project. We've never had a highway project in the state funded by the users through tolls. They're also going to fund the maintenance and operation of the project. And over time, as the tolls are paid off and we start generating surplus revenue, they will be helping to fund the general highway program of the entire state.
Yeah. And again, I have no idea what the cost will be to expand the Glen Highway to accommodate the extra traffic, but that might be an interesting comparison, the bridge versus just expanding the Glen Highway.
The latest estimate I've heard, Mr. Chairman, is about $600 million just to add the pair of lanes all the way out to the Parks Glen Y.
Okay, thank you. All right, so Senator Wilson, I'm sorry we interrupted you. Proceed with your question.
Sure. I guess just a point you'd made before I go on with the other line of questioning, Mr. Austin. You talked about the Metsu borough being very active in bonding for the projects that are there. Why aren't they bonding for this project? They're directly affected.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, they're essentially bonding roads that are local in nature. I know of no experience anywhere in the state where a community has participated in a national highway system route. Just can't think of one.
Some of the other more specific questions that I have is as we look at how is this project, or how is STIP involved in, how is this project involved in the STIP funding process that goes on out there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not sure I follow your question.
Well, if you have this STIP, mostly roads have been had some type of STIP consideration. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
Is the STIP involved in this?
Well, the STIP is involved in that this project has to be put on the STIP because it is using federal funding. The federal earmarks I spoke of that it's received to date, it's considered a federal project because of the use of those funds. It'll have to be on the STIP. Whether it's, but the type of funding you show on the STIP can be the bonds or the TIFIA funding or the federal aid that we're proposing here. But it's essentially a federalized project and has to be depicted in the STIP.
And as we look at that, if we're starting to take money from other projects in order to go ahead and as was pointed out earlier on, that other projects are going to be put on hold because, quote-unquote, they're not shovel-ready, I guess, can you identify some of those and tell me how long they're going to have to be waiting?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the typical project would have to wait, you know, 1 or 2 years as compared to the current backlog. We already have a 12-year list of projects. So yeah, that the average wait would be 6 years for that list just without this project. We're adding about another year's worth of funding demand on our funding stream. So you've really changed the wait from 6 years to about 6.5 years if you just look at it arithmetically. The types of projects we will look at are the ones that the need for them is not as evident as it was when they were started, and the gas pipeline is a perfect example of that. That we're not building a pipeline down the Alaska Highway. We're not delivering, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles of pipe up the Haines Highway. So projects that were started under a different proposition, the proposition that we had a 4-foot diameter pipeline coming to Alaska along the route to Alberta, it's a perfect example of the type of project we can delay with very little impact to the traveling public.
But continue, Mr. Chairman. The sentiment within the Senate, at least at the Finance Committee here, has been, and with the Senate in general, especially within the majority caucus, has been that projects that have already been started should be finished because in the long run it'll cost more to have these projects slowed down. But I see you doing exactly that same thing. Those projects that are out there that are already started are going to have to wait even longer, which means the end cost of those projects are going to be millions, if not tens of millions of dollars, more expensive than if we finish them off. And so why would you, with that, I'm assuming you agree as soon as we get a project started, the sooner we get it finished, the less it's going to cost. Why would, as a public policy entity like ourselves, why would we be in favor of this?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we essentially have that same dilemma with Kubota. We've started it too. We spent over $100 million in progressing that project. So we're going to have to delay something. If we don't do the Kubota project, yes, we may do those other projects faster. But bottom line is, at some point, you make a choice, which is the most important to the overall benefit of the state.
As we look at, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue.
Go ahead, Senator Olson.
As you look at the numbers, though, that are there, it's the same people giving us the numbers last year when we had the PPA that are giving us the numbers now. How can we have confidence in those numbers that the legislative auditor said, you know, were somewhat questionable at best? I mean, I see that as a problem when you start dealing with the same people giving you another set of numbers that could be just as bogus as the ones were last year.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. I think the key number I would focus on, there are differences in cost estimates that can be explained by whether you're considering all costs prior to date as opposed to all costs going forward, cost of finance, et cetera. Those are differences that are quite explainable. But the biggest difference that I notice is we now only need one-third of the traffic to make this project successful to pay off its bond debt to TIFIA than we needed under the old scheme where you needed to finance the entire project with bonds at a higher interest rate. So you had a combination of more principal being borrowed at a much higher interest rate because of the nature of the financing.
Maybe any other questions before? Yeah, okay. Why don't we, Senator Olson, if that's okay.
Let me get spooled back up here. I'm kind of
You know, I think in my opinion here, we either spend $600 million on expanding the Glen Highway or we spend $600 million and take out some $300 million, I guess, if you don't include the bond payments, you know, for a bridge and have another way in and out of Anchorage. Again, one of the concerns with the Glen Highway is there's only, if there's an accident there, it's blocked off. People can't leave. People can't get into Anchorage. And the bridge does offer another alternative route, which is what it's intriguing.
Mr. Chairman, just one comment on point there. It's my understanding, and Mr. Otteson has better knowledge than I do, that it's my understanding that they're planning on expanding the Glen Highway already anyway. So I don't see it. I mean, that's already been planned.
Yeah, I don't know if you would do both. Mr. Otteson, maybe you can address that.
Well, through the chair, to both of you, the Glen Highway will need to be expanded in the future. But to the extent that we draw traffic off the Glen with the Kubota project, we will buy some time on that future expansion of the Glen. I think you will give people alternative routes at times of emergency or breakdowns. You know, we've all heard the stories of the 4 and 5 and 6 hour waits when there's a major fatality accident on the Glen Highway. Those kinds of things will become a thing of the past.
And those are concerns to our constituents and Senator Dunleavy's constituents, and maybe not so much in Nome, but that is concerned our folks in South Central. But let me go over here to Senator Dunleavy. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, through the chair. What are some economic benefits to this project related to other transportation projects? Will this does this help with other projects with that are dealing with federal receipts as well?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. Well, the idea that we have a project that first pays for part of its own costs, the TIFIA funds are being paid for by the user's fees. Next, it will be paying for the state bonds, even if it doesn't pay for them in real time. And by real time, I mean during the 20 or 25 years in which those payments are coming due, those future toll receipts can repay the state for that investment. It also pays for its own operating costs, which will be substantial. And eventually, when all those other debts are cared for and traffic has built up, the bridge has probably been built to 4 lanes because it's being designed as a 4-lane structure, but with only 2 lanes of roadway, that will be paid for by the toll receipts. Eventually, you reach a point where this project is contributing dollars to the overall transportation needs of statewide, every corner of the state, subject to the legislature's appropriation as to which projects would be funded. So there's just no other project that we're proposing in the past or in the future that I know that has this set of benefits.
Senator Dudley.
Yes. Question. If TIFI is not approved, is it my understanding that Kubota would still continue developing a plan to get federal aid?
Through the chair, if the TIFIA is not approved, we would have the federal aid through the highway program, and then we would have to work with revenue and the same team that put this financial plan together on a plan B. And that would have to be approved by Federal Highway Administration before we could continue to a contract.
And would you have to come back to the legislature for that plan to be approved as well?
It would depend on what the plan consisted of, I would think.
One last question.
Sure, go ahead.
What you know, once again, what you know from the plan last year versus this year, and both of you can chime in. My understanding is that you're feeling pretty good about the ability to fund it, to service the debt, in terms of estimated traffic, that it's a viable plan. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, yes.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes. I feel this is a very sound plan with tremendous benefits for the state. You just can't look on the, you can't stand on the far side of the kicking arm, you know, right there at Port McKenzie, look back at the proximity of downtown Anchorage and not recognize this bridge will generate traffic. It will come.
And just one point of clarification. Early, there was a little bit of confusion, I guess, on my part. If the Kinnick Arm Bridge moves forward and undergoes construction, there was question whether the Glen Highway was already slated for expansion. And I'm not sure if what you said after that was, if the Kinnick Arm Bridge is built, that will allow us some time before we have to expand the Glen, or is the Glen going to be expanded anyway? Please answer that.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. Currently, widening the Glen Highway beyond its current amount of, it starts out at three lanes and drops down to two. I think it's even four lanes in places, but it is not an active project except for the GL bonded project that was funded in 2012 there at Artillery Road and the Eagle River off-ramp. And that's only funded currently in the outbound direction. So, you know, we recognize there's need work that's going to have to be done to the Glen, but it's not currently in the queue of pre-construction.
And one last question. What's the estimate and how much traffic would be routed through the bridge and off the Glen, in other words, siphoned off the Glen and going down the Kinnick Bridge?
You have the numbers?
Through the chair, we don't have, you know, direct siphon off numbers. Initially, we expect that the traffic will be from Anchorage to the Lower Mat-Su for the purposes of, you know, constructing homes, that type of thing. We'll have some commuters that it is a benefit in the initial years, but it's not a direct like percentage that you pull off the Glen. There's going to be in our anticipation, there's going to be increased activity at Port McKenzie. There's going to be industrial activity that moves over to the Mat-Su, just because of the constraints of the Anchorage Bowl at this time. So the overflow from Anchorage is what we'll see initially.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop, you had a quick question. I think we have floor session 11, but I haven't heard bells, so we can keep going.
Mr. Chairman, they'll be back, correct?
There's bells.
Yeah, we'll do
yes.
I'll just save it. I'll hold it. Thank you.
Look, what we're going to have to do, and unfortunately we have a lot of people here who wanted to testify as well, and I, again, apologize for not getting to the folks. What I think we'll do is we'll bring this up next week. We're going to be spending the next several days now on the operating budget starting tonight. And we're going to get some new fiscal notes, is my understanding, on this. So for now, I think we need to set this aside till probably early next week. It is a House bill, so we have time. I think the chairman, co-chairman here, wants to just recess until 5 o'clock tonight, and he'll have a CS for the operating budget. And then tomorrow we'll be taking public testimony on the operating budget. So with that, we are recessed till 5 o'clock.
Check, check, check. Mic check.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Center Finance. It's Wednesday, March 19th, and we are going to be hearing HB 266 and HB 267, certainly 266 tonight. Present at the table are Senator Meyer, Senator Olson, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, Senator Fairclough, and myself, Senator Kelly. James, you're here to talk about the operating budget. Do we need to make a motion to get 266 before us? That's probably not a bad idea. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt work draft 28-GH2671-G, dated 3/19/14, as the working document.
Without objection, Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 266, Finance / G version, is adopted as our working draft. Mr. Armstrong?
James Armstrong, staff to Senator Kelly. At the back table, it's being distributed now. There'll be four documents that Legislative Finance has prepared. The first one is a document that shows all funds that's in contained within the governor or within the Senate Finance proposed CS. The second one contains all general funds, unrestricted general funds, and designated general funds. Third document has it listed as unrestricted general funds, formula and non-formula total spend. And the fourth one does a comparison of unrestricted general funds, non-formula, referring to the agencies. So I can walk through the changes on all four of those if you'd like, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Okay. For all funds, the governor's proposal had total spending of $12,195,387,000. The Senate subcommittee has spending at $9,148,106,000 for a difference of $3,047,281,000. $3 billion of that, it should be noted, is the governor included $3 billion for the retirement contribution perks and TERS. That is not contained in this document. So a second way to look at the budget, as in most years people have, is to look at all general funds, UGF and DGF. And the governor's proposed budget had $5,878,924,000. The Senate CS proposes $5,818,968,000 for a reduction of nearly $60 million. The third document behind me from Ledge Finance has a comparison, so it takes it a step further. We just looked at the day-to-day agency operations of the formula programs and the non-formula programs contained within the budget and did a comparison using unrestricted general funds. The governor proposed $4 billion. Well, let me hold back. So when we do that, we're taking $1.5 billion from statewide operations off the table. So that's where we get to the governor's proposed $4,370,000.
That $1.5 billion are the DGF, correct?
We took out the DGF, but we also took out statewide operations.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So, in that scenario, the Senate subcommittee is $33,641,000 below the governor's. The fourth and last way to look at the budget, we looked at agency day-to-day operations, and we took out the non-formula portion of the budget. So if you do it segregated down like that, the governor proposes to spend $2,270,000,000. The Senate proposed CS spends $2,243,000,000 for a difference of $26,343,000. In that scenario, the difference between the 4.3 and the 2.7 has removed K-12 formula education and Medicaid formula funding. So the subcommittee work represents a 1.1% decrement to agency operations as proposed to the governor's FY15 request. As you've worked through this budget, the governor also provided his own decrements to the budget. So if you're comparing the Senate CS to the management plan of fiscal year 14, which when we left town last year, it's a $53,191,000 reduction, or about 2.2% from last year's day-to-day operations of state government.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Let the record reflect that Senator Hoffman has joined us. Any questions? We'll take a brief at ease. We also have the mental health budget before us, which is Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 267, Finance. Senator Meyer, could I get a motion to adopt the version Y as our working draft, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Finance Committee adopt working draft 28-GH2673/Y. Dated 3/19/14 as the working document before us.
For the record, I'll read the whole bill, the Senate CS for House Bill number 267, Finance Version Y, has been adopted as our working draft. Mr. Armstrong?
Mr. Chairman, we have some house cleaning stuff to take care of. I just wanted to tell members of some stuff that is not in this version of the bill, mostly in the language section.
And you're referring to 266 at this time?
266, I'm sorry, yes. Right now, we'll deal with these two at the table next week sometime. There's some negotiated contract settlements with the University of Alaska and PSEA. Those two are not in this bill, but we will deal with them next week. I already mentioned that the infusion of $3 billion is not in this version of the bill. some intent language was added by the other body into the language section. We just haven't had time to review it.
Yes.
So those three things, dealing with crime victims' rights, recidivism reduction, and ASME program funding, were removed. They'll be conferenceable. Excuse me. One thing, the fuel trigger section that contained $30 million as proposed by the governor was reduced by $3 billion. It represents a $9 million reduction, yeah, and a 25% reduction in the program. The other side made numerous technical changes per ledge finance, per ONB, just changing it. Side-by-side comparisons of the language can be found on the ledge finance website, as all other pertinent documents relating to this document. The deadline for the amendments to your office is Friday at 4 p.m., this coming Friday. And Donnie and her staff are preparing binders for each member that has the narratives and the spreadsheets. So when you're in public testimony tomorrow, you can sit there and reference them.
And I would encourage members to talk with your colleagues about what is in or out of the budget at this point. And if you want changes, it's going to have to be through the amendment process, and please get them to the office by what time Friday? Did you say 4 o'clock on Friday? 4 o'clock on Friday. And tomorrow is beginning at 9 o'clock. We have public testimony on this.
Yeah, the first community's up at 9, Bethel, Nome, and Kotzebue. It's all listed on basis, and we'd scroll through all the communities in the next 2 days.
Questions from the committee?
One other thing.
Go ahead, Mr. Archer.
I think my mother may be watching in Soldotna, and tomorrow is her birthday.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday, Mrs. Armstrong. There's nothing else to come before the committee? We're adjourned.